nanohub.org. You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Enjoy the show.
Okay, so today I'd like to continue with our discussion of this, what we have been talking about, the elastic transport model or the Landauer model, which is that you think of electrons as going through your device without exchanging any energy with the surroundings, and then you lose, the electron loses energy at the two ends. This is the what I'd call the Landauer model. And of course, you couldn't in principle apply it to something that was a millimeter long, because an electron wouldn't go through a millimeter without losing energy. But conceptually, as I mentioned, at least for low bias, low voltages, that is in the linear IV range, you could think of a long device as lots of little devices, little Landauer devices in series. And in each one of them, you could think of it as if it goes for a while and then loses energy, goes for a while and then loses energy. And that gets you a pretty good description of what happens in small devices and also what happens in big devices at low bias. So that's what we are talking about. And what I'd like to go on to today is a very important effect that you always talk about. Like the first things you measure about any conductor is its conductivity and the Hall voltage, the Hall resistance. And that's like the first measurements you would make on any conductor. So we have talked about conductivity. Today I wanted to go on to this Hall effect, which is a little more difficult, involves some additional concepts. Now, just to remind you what we were talking about, if you remember, the expression we obtained, write it here, for current looks something like Q integral dE F plus F minus. See, the idea was that if you think of any conductor and you have this density of states in this region, and the density of states you could conceptually break up into two parts, the one that goes to the right and the other that goes to the left. So that's the d over 2. So half of it is to the right, half of it is to the left. And the ones that are going to the right are occupied according to what I called f plus. Ones that are going to the left, say they're occupied according to f minus. And the net current is like Q and V. So it's Q, N is this half D times F, that tells you the electron density, because D is density of states. This tells you what fraction are occupied, and then the V. So this would be the argument. And then what we discussed is that what is this F plus minus F minus? Well, if we are talking about a ballistic conductor, then it would just be equal to F1 minus F2. So if F1 is this, F2 is that, you just take the difference. That's F plus minus F minus. Why? Because in a ballistic conductor, anything going to the right does not couple to the left moving traffic. So it is sort of like you have this interstate running from Lafayette to Chicago and you cannot turn around. So in that case, all northbound lanes are filled up according to conditions at Lafayette. All southbound lanes are filled up according to conditions in Chicago. That seems pretty reasonable. That's exactly what you'd have. Now, on the other hand, in diffusive transport, of course, the electrons can turn round. In fact, every time it goes a certain distance dx, a fraction dx over lambda turns around. In any that's kind of the definition of mean free path. In any length dx, what fraction of the electrons would turn around? And when we considered that, what we came up with was this picture of what F plus and F minus would look like across this device. What would it look like? Well, it would start out at F1, That's the Lafayette end of things. And then as it goes through the device, it would come down and reach some value here. On the other hand, if you looked at the southbound traffic, it would start out at F2, that's at the Chicago end, and it would actually pick up and then go somewhere here. So this is the thing that we've been discussing last week. So this is z equals, let's write it here, z equals 0. This is z equals L. And you could write the occupation F anywhere in between from a knowledge of F1 and F2. It's basically the straight line that runs through. The straight line that connects this end to that end. And what we discussed is that if you looked at this as a fraction of the whole thing, so then this much would be like lambda over lambda plus L of the whole thing. That's what we went through last time. Okay. Now, two important concepts, and I'm kind of stressing it because these are important things to grasp, because otherwise everything else we talk about won't make much sense. And that is, the way you think about F, it is a function of energy. So when I'm drawing a curve like this as a function of Z, you really mean at a fixed energy. You say, okay, at a given energy, what does the occupation look like from left to right? Now, for low bias, the important point I tried to make last day is that for low bias, you could interpret this as a chemical potential. So what I mean by that is, you see, mu 1 tells you the chemical potential here, which means it tells you up to what level the states are occupied. In between, the occupation is going down to this, and you could view this as a curve that tells you how the occupation, the chemical potential, how the chemical potential actually changes from left to right. Now, this is not generally true. This is only true if we are talking about voltages less than kT, kT over Q. Now, you might say, well, usually, of course, when you have a resistor with a, you know, linear resistor, I could be applying 5 volts across it. kT is only 25 millivolts. But the point I made before is, when you are talking of big resistors or conductors, you should only think about an inelastic length, because you have to think of this big thing as lots of little things in series. And the thing is, normally a resistor would become nonlinear once the voltage drop across an inelastic length exceeds kT. Okay? So as long as we're talking about this short part of it, short section of it, I'd say voltage across it, in order to remain in this low bias regime, should be less than. That's not quite generally true, but almost. So the voltage across this small thing should be less than 25 millivolts or so at room temperature. Now, if you accept that, then the point is that you could think of the F as a mu. Why is that? Well, it goes something like this, that you see, all energy channels are independent, and what you could do is, based on what we are discussing, you could write F of E and Z as a linear combination of F1 and F2. So it would be sum A times F1 plus 1 minus A times F2. This just follows from the differential equation that we discussed last week. Because this solution is linear, no matter where you go, the answer is like a linear combination of what's here and what's there. It's just a straight line. Okay? So you could write the distribution anywhere as a linear combination of F1 and F2. And if you have, say, 50% here, this is also 50%. If it's 30 here, it's 70. 70, it's 30. That way. Okay? So now, in general, then, if I add two Fermi functions like this, do I get another Fermi function? No, not in general. Because, and that you can check easily. If you have a Fermi function like this, and another one, say, like this, and you add the two, let's say 50% of this and 50% of that, you'd end up with something like that, which is not a Fermi function. Now, and of course, if it's not a Fermi function, then we cannot quite talk about an electrochemical potential. Because as you know, the Fermi function is defined as, it looks something like this. And as long as a function as of energy, you know, looks like this, you could describe it just with one number. If I told you mu, you know what it is. And kT, of course. But if it doesn't look like this, of course, and if you have a function like this, then it's debatable what exactly mu means in that context. If it's like this or like this. Now, the thing is, the example I took here, of course, doesn't qualify for this low bias like we defined it. Why? Because the way I've drawn this kT is very small, while the mu difference is that much. And as I said, for this low bias, it's like your voltage difference, the voltage mu 1 minus mu 2 ought to be much less than kT. So this isn't quite a good diagram to be testing out what we are saying. So it's more like something like this. You have to consider something like this, something which has a big spread. And then what you can show is that once you add two things like that, this also looks something like that. It looks Fermi function-like. And mathematically, the way that would work is that, you see, in general, what happens is that this F plus minus F minus, if you remember, we discussed, we could write this as lambda over lambda plus L times F1 minus F2. And this gives us the current. Now, how did we get an expression for conductance? Well, in order to do that, we did a Taylor series expansion on this. So what I said is, instead of F1 minus F2, let us write it as minus del F del E times mu1 minus mu2. And of course, this Taylor series expansion, again, only works as long as mu1 minus mu2 is way less than kT. And in that case, adding, you know, taking difference of Fermi functions is like taking difference of these two mu's, etc. So what that means is that we are that as long as we are in this linear regime of things where this Taylor series expansion works, I could view this as if the chemical potential looks like this across the device. So instead of Fs, I could view this as mu, and this is like mu plus. This is like mu minus. It tells me how the electrochemical potential. By the way, when I say mu, it means the technical name is electrochemical potential. I sometimes say chemical potential, but what I really mean is electrochemical. And if you are not quite familiar with the difference, I mean, don't worry about it right now. The main, as far as this is concerned, what it tells you is just how the states are occupied. If something is higher, it means it's occupied to a higher level. That's it. Okay, so mu's look like this. Now, what's the advantage of having, of interpreting this as a mu? Well, firstly, of course, you previously had a function of f e comma z. Now you just need to talk about a mu comma z, mu as a function of z. And anytime you can reduce independent variables, it's always a whole lot easier to visualize things. You know, instead of having something be a function of two things, it always helps to have it a function of one thing. That's But the other point is that, you see, one of the important difficulties with ballistic conductors in the early days was this extra term here. That is, you know, in high school or in freshman classes, you learn R equals rho L over A. And from that, everyone expected that if L goes to 0, resistance should go to 0. But experimentally, of course, the fact is that's not true. Once you get to small things, It saturates to a certain value, and there is a fundamental limit to what it can be. And that you can include by putting this in there. And of course, this is something that came out of our discussion very simply with this lambda plus L there. Now, the question that comes up is, when you have something really small, where exactly is the resistance? Because after all, you know, electrons are going through without any scattering. So that was the question that puzzled everyone. And the thing is that since the current is the same everywhere here, it's like a series circuit, one way to find out where is the resistance is, look at where is the voltage. Because delta V equals I delta R in a way. So here you can see this is dropping continuously. So that tells you must have a continuously distributed resistance around here. Once you get to the ends, what you notice is this interesting point that you see the entire voltage that you applied is that much. But by the time you get here to this other end of the device, only that much has dropped. You still, you know, this is, if you look at any one of these, either mu plus or mu minus, just any one of them, or you could look at the average. But if you look at mu plus, for example, you notice it's dropped that much, but then this much, the rest of it has to drop somewhere inside the contact. Because inside the contact, somewhere you expect this to come down and join up with mu 2. Deep inside a contact, that those two have to connect up. So you'd say that much of the resistance, that fraction of the resistance is actually device resistance. And that fraction is what you'd call an interface resistance, something that's associated with this contact being in contact to the device. See, and this is the part that in the beginning people didn't recognize and, you know, took a long time to actually get it clear. Now, the question you could ask is, well, why does it have to go down there? And this is where the important concept is that what distinguishes your contact from your real device is that in the real device, you have, let's say, 10 channels, you know, some density of states times V. You know, as I said before, this is a quantity that can be interpreted as the number of channels that carry your current, like the number of lanes on your highway. Once you get into the contact, you have got many, many more channels. So it's like these tens of channels spread out into 10,000 channels. And it is that spreading part of it, it's going from 10 to 10,000, that is where this voltage has to drop, and that's where there's the resistance. Why does it have to drop? Well, because you see, it's a series circuit. The current is the same everywhere. And how much is the current? Well, the current is, as you can see from here, the number of channels times the voltage difference. As I said, F plus minus F minus, you can think of as mu plus minus mu minus, if you put a del F del E out here. And if this is small, say 10, then you might need a certain delta mu. If this is 10,000, then you'll need a whole lot smaller delta mu to carry the same current. So once you are inside here, you don't need that much delta mu to carry your current anymore. Just this much is good now. And in the limit, as this goes to infinity, that kind of becomes zero. That's the way you think about it. So the important thing, conceptual point it clarifies, is that this extra resistance here is associated with going from 10 channels to 10,000 channels. That's the important thing, is this spreading out, a spreading resistance that people talk about. And this is kind of important because I said that when you have a long device, you could think of it as lots of little ones in series. But there's a caveat, and that is, you see, if you had a small device whose resistance is, like I wrote there, rho over A L plus lambda, and now I take N of them and put them in series, you might think it is this. After all, series, all so many resistors in series. But the correct answer is really this one. Why is that? Well, because if you're taking a really long device here and breaking it up into little things like this, this extra term here is associated with going from 10 to 10,000 more channels. And that happens only at the end. It's not like in between you are spreading it out from 10 to 10,000 every time. If you did that, then the correct answer would have been this. If, like in every section, you spread it out from 10 to 10,000. If you don't, then the thing is that spreading happens once at the two ends. Yeah.
So if I had a device with a, let's say, semiconducting channel and the contact, which is the metal, so which lambda do I take for this calculation? Is it the semiconductor, the mean free path, or that one in the metal?
It's a semiconductor, actually. Now, good point. The reason is this, that, yeah, as I put L equals 0, what you get is rho lambda over A. And it looks like this depends on the mean free path. Now, that's kind of misleading. And that is because, you see, this rho in the first place depends inversely on the mean free path. So actually, that rho lambda is something that cancels out, which just depends on how many channels you have. Although written this way, it's kind of misleading. Seems like it has all kinds of dependencies on the mean free path. So what lambda should you use? I'd say whatever lambda goes in there, so it cancels out properly. Yeah. So yeah, this is the thing that we'll talk about like next week or so, or later this week. And that is, as I mentioned, this quantity can be interpreted as the number of channels. And at this level, you wouldn't have expected to be this to be integer or quantized or anything. But an important result of mesoscopic physics is that this quantity is actually h over q squared, which is this quantum of resistance, divided by an integer. That isn't obvious from anything we've discussed so far. No, but this entire drop is due to scatterers, right? Because if it was ballistic, then as you know, this curve would have looked like this. If it was ballistic, then it would be occupied according to F1 all the way and then drop somewhere inside. And it would, and the reverse ones would be occupied according to F2 all the way and then drop somewhere inside.
I mean to say that how will the picture really change if we have the scatterers in which energy exchange also happens?
Yeah, but thing is that this drop happens as long as positive, as long as these electrons can turn around. So what I'm saying is the important part is not so much the energy exchange as the momentum exchange. So if you had a whole bunch of lanes here, you know, and some of which are say 70 miles per hour lanes, some of them are 50 miles per hour lane, and that would be like changing energy, I suppose. But as long as you're still going towards Chicago, it doesn't matter much. What matters is the fact that you have turned around. Otherwise, the picture wouldn't really change too much, even if you moved around there.
So, you're saying that this extra resistance term is coming because the channels are going from 10 to 10,000.
From here to here.
If we had like a very bad contact and the channels are going to say from 10 to 20, then how would that change?
Right. Then the actual resistance, where yeah, this we'll talk about a little later. As I said, this thing is h over q squared times the number of modes, as I mentioned before. That's what we'll see. And when you are, this is given that you have a channel with m channels and then you go into infinite channels. Now, if you go from m1 to m2, then actually the answer is like 1 over m1 minus 1 over m2. And if this is infinite, then this. So otherwise, there would be a smaller resistance associated with it. And the idea is then, eventually, of course, this has to go to infinite once you get to your bonding pads or something. Okay. That's the picture.
So as you increase the gap of the surface, scattering increases.
as you increase the gate voltage. Two parts of the story, right? One is that with the gate voltage, you could be moving your chemical potential up and down anyway. Okay? That's a separate story with the gate voltage, because the way it works is, if you put a voltage here, you can raise this entire density of states up or down relative to the contacts. Or equivalently, you could say this is fixed and it's as if the contacts are moving up and down. Right. So that part of it, I would say, is reflected in that lambda. So, you know, this, when we obtained this, we wrote something like df plus dz equals df minus dz equals minus f plus minus f minus over lambda. And the argument was, what's this lambda? It's this mean free path, which tells you that in a given length dz, what fraction of electrons get turned around. Now, if you have a little extra surface scattering, it just makes your mean free path smaller. So, it's part of that. Okay. Yeah, so in this description, one of the puzzling things, again, puzzling meaning if you are used to, if you know about the usual way people think about current flow, is that the driving term is always believed to be the electric field. That's how you usually write it. You write J equals sigma E. But the correct formula is really J equals sigma del mu. In other words, what current is really driven by gradient in the electrochemical potential, not so much the electric field. That's one of the things you learn in devices also, that, you know, when you have a PN junction, there's an enormous electric field. But sitting by itself, there's no current at all. Right? So it's not really the electric field that drives the current. What drives the current is a difference in electrochemical potentials, finally. So the way we have discussed this, for example, the reason electrons are flowing from left to right is because mu 1 is bigger than mu 2. Now, actually, as you know, this is the mu. Somewhere down here, you have this edge of the conduction band, like this one, EC. And the way I have discussed it, we haven't talked about electric fields at all. If there were an electric field, as you know, this edge of the conduction band, it would go down like that. You know, just as the mu is going down like so, so would the edge of the conduction band. That's what reflects this electric field. Now, how would that come in a discussion? That, as I said last day, if you did this calculation self-consistently, then what would have happened is, if you started with a situation like this, you'd find you got lots of electrons here, very few electrons here. So, if everything has a uniform positive background, it would mean there's fewer electrons here, so it's positively charged. And because it's positively charged, when you solve Poisson equation self-consistently, this would gradually go down. So, it would end up there. So, if you did this entire calculation self-consistently, at the end of the day, it would have looked something like this. But the actual variation of the electric field, that depends on Debye length and things like that, which comes from Poisson equation. But basically, the current is being driven by this difference in mu's. Now, one question you could ask is, the current that flows in a structure like this, would it be different if it were like this or like this? So, let me call this A, call this B. So, two hypothetical conductors, one of which has no electric field, but has a certain delta mu. Another one, B, which has the same delta mu, but also has an electric field in it, conceptually. If you had these two, question is, would you have more current in one or the other? My guess is, actually, I think you'd get more current here. But that is a kind of second order thing. Second order thing is because, you see, the electrons here, the amount of kinetic energy they have is measured by how far above the bottom of the band they are. So, in this case, because it's far above the bottom of the band, it's got actually a little more extra energy. What that means is, it would actually end up with a bigger conductivity. So, I would think of this as that the presence of the electric field could make it a little more conductive than it normally wants to be. That's all. In a ballistic conductor, as a result, you could get a little extra current, but again, for low bias, I think it's not, it's, this is more like a higher order nonlinear effect that we don't need to get into. So as far as linear low bias is concerned, and you're trying to understand the linear resistance, I'd say the entire story you can just get by looking at the electrochemical potentials. That's it. Now, so this is then what the electrochemical potential would look like at low bias as a function of Z. Now, question you could ask is, what would it look like as a function of X? That's in the transverse direction. And ordinarily, I'd say, okay, so this is Z. Now, let's say we try to write it as a function of X. And ordinarily, you'd think it should be the same everywhere, whatever it is. So I'm trying to draw it as a function of X. So it means let's say I fix my attention somewhere here at some point in Z, somewhere in the middle. And then I'm looking at what it looks like along X. And you'd say, well, it should be the same across, all the way across. And that's true. But the interesting thing, and that's what the Hall effect is based on, is that if you actually apply a magnetic field perpendicular to the plane, then you'll find that this, well, I guess they're not the same one, it will do something like this across the width of this sample. So from X equals 0 to W, it would actually be changing if you looked at any point. And it would change linearly. This discussion. Yeah, that's it. And this difference is what you call the Hall voltage. Voltage meaning, I'm drawing chemical potentials. Anytime you want to go to voltage, you divide it by Q. That's understood. So, and this Hall voltage is proportional to the magnetic field. Now, why is that important? Well, because of a very interesting result that, which goes like this, that if you look at the Hall resistance, which is, I guess, VH divided by I. That's a resistance. And that ends up being equal to 1 over Qn, where n is electron density. And I think there's a B here. So I think B over Qn. So usually, by measuring this Hall resistance, you have a current flowing, you look at the Hall voltage, and it's proportional to B, proportional to the magnetic field, and by looking at this proportionality, you can actually deduce the electron density. So now, I've said that often people think of conductivity as being Q, N, mu, and the mobility. And the question is, how do you actually get mobility? Well, the way it works is, you measure conductivity, then you often make the measure Hall resistance, from which you deduce this much. And then from a knowledge of this and this, you try to figure that one out. That's how it usually works. The other way to get this would be, if you know the capacitance of your gate, then just from how much of gate voltage you have applied, you might try to deduce it, which would be a little more indirect. Whereas this is more direct. You're actually looking at a measurement and getting this out of it. So that's why it's so important, because it allows you to separate this out mentally. Okay. So now the question is, how do you understand what voltage to expect here? And in our way of thinking then, again talking of electrons with a fixed energy, and usually at a fixed energy, so let me, and we are just talking about a two-dimensional conductor here, So let me take this off. So what you'd have is, so this is Z, this is X. Now usually electrons kind of going in all directions have, could have velocities in any of these directions, you know, uniformly more or less over Z and X in that plane. And what I called plus and minus basically is everything to the right. Anybody who is, has a positive Z, kind of call them plus. Anybody who is negative Z, call them minus. See, that's how we wrote this F plus and F minus. Because, and that's why there's this VZ here. That refers to, and that's a positive number. You just take the magnitude, the extra minus kind of went in there. Anyway, so this is how you normally think of there. Now, what a magnetic field does is that any electron that is moving in a certain direction, it tends to rotate it. So it tends to turn it around like so. And the basic result, which needs a little discussion, but I'm sure you've seen this before, is that if you had an electron with a certain velocity, and remember here we are talking of electrons with a fixed energy, which means the magnitude of the velocity remains the same. So any electron, if it has a velocity, say here, in a magnetic field, would just keep going around in a circle, basically. Any electron would just be, if it has a different energy, it would have a different velocity, and then it would be going around like so. Okay. So the point is that any electron then in a magnetic field wants to go around in a circle, and the time it takes, that's what's described as the cyclotron resonance frequency, this omega c. That's like the period of this going around. And the expression for omega c is qb over m. And yeah, I'm sure you have seen this before, and we'll talk more about it later anyway. So for the moment, let me just take that. So the thing is, then, that if you have, say, electrons whose velocities are uniformly distributed here, then you might expect that any time you put on a magnetic field, the distribution would just rotate, like so. And if it's uniform, nothing would change. The overall distribution of things wouldn't change. But supposing we have actually current being carried, so it is this part that is occupied, then when I rotate it, it kind of wants to go become like this, which means I am actually losing some from here, which used to have a negative x velocity, and putting them here so they have a positive x velocity. Now, this wouldn't be the case if it was all uniform, of course. But supposing we have a situation where we have current flow in one direction, and so this side is a lot more occupied than that side. In fact, let's simplify it by saying that we only have electrons going this way, nothing here. Then you see immediately that what this does is it tends to turn that rotating thing. So what we could do is, just as we had written, in order to derive this, if you remember, we wrote this equation df plus dz equals df minus dz equals minus f plus minus f minus over lambda. That's what we had written. That's what we solved to obtain this. You could try to write a similar equation here, but now in the x direction. So what I mean by that is we took plus and minus and did this. Now let's think of this half and this half. And I'll give it two names. I'll just call this left and right, something. So just so you know, because plus and minus refer to going this way, but left and right is like going upwards or downwards. So I'll call that left or right. So I'm giving it a different name so that you don't confuse with the plus and minus. So you could write something like dFL dx is equal to dFr dx is equal to minus FL minus FR over lambda. Much the same way you could have written this. But we have an additional term. And the additional term comes from the fact that you see the magnetic field is continually turning it like this. And as long as only the right half is occupied, because of the magnetic field, you keep taking stuff out of here and putting them here. That's the extra term that the magnetic field brings into it. Because if this was the whole story, then I'd have said, well, as long as it's no current can flow in the x direction, FL must be equal to FR. And hence the solution to that is FL and FR are both constant, which of course is just this curve. It's the same across the whole thing. No change. So that's the solution to this equation. No current flows in the x direction. If this is it, FL must be equal to FR because no current flows. We can't, don't let it flow out anywhere. And that must be the same everywhere. That's zero. But now what happens is you get a term here that's proportional to B. And so although FL is equal to FR, so I can drop that term still. No current flows. I'm measuring the hall voltage. No current flows. So that's I can drop still. But now there will be a constant gradient to this, which will depend on the magnetic field. And so when I actually plot FL and FR, they will both just track each other, no current. So FL and FR are right on top of each other, but it will be a little higher on this side than on that side, and there will be a slope that's proportional to the magnetic field. So the main thing I need to figure out is exactly what to put here. That's the basic part. And that, I'd say, is then what leads to the leads to a Hall voltage across the thing. So if I have to write this, the idea is that, so think of, again, thinking where best to, so I could try to write it like this, delta FL is equal to this, so the so we are what we are thinking of here, let me take this out. So what we are thinking of here is a little slab in the x direction whose length is delta x. And you have electrons coming in from here, and then we are asking how much is the change. And the delta FL would be equal to, it will be proportional to this thing here, that how, because in a given length of time it rotates by that much, so it would be omega c times the time it spends in this region, which is delta x divided by v. So omega c times tau, that tells me how much it rotates, because it rotates at the rate of omega c. Omega c tau tells you the angle by which it rotates. And what I know is that this will be proportional to this times the, I guess, the fractional occupation. You know, we are thinking of the plus states being all occupied. So this is, and question is, this is the amount by which it rotates, and I divide it by half pi, and that then tells me the fraction that rotates. What I mean by that is, you see here, this angle is half pi over 2, and that it has rotated by that much. So how many electrons are occupied? Well, that's the fraction that is occupied, that is affected. So this fraction of the total got transferred from here into there. So, and then I can take the delta x here and put it here. So that's how I would end up with an expression for the dFL dx. And you'll see it is proportional to omega c, that's the cyclotron resonance frequency, which is proportional to the magnetic field. Remember, what I was trying to say is that the dFL dx, let me write this here, kind of, is equal to dFr dx is equal to omega c over pi over 2. So that's the bottom line to where I was trying to get. Now, so again, just to go through the argument, just to repeat what I said, essentially, how are we getting this factor here? So what I said is that if f plus were equal to f minus, which means if everything was uniformly occupied, there would be all these derivatives would be 0. You just rotate the whole thing, makes no difference. The only reason you have some dFl dx or dFr dx is because one of these is more than the other. So for the moment in this thinking, let's think of it like you don't even have that. We're just talking of things going in the positive direction, which means only this half is occupied. Occupied, and let's say f plus is 1. So they're all fully occupied for that matter. Okay. Now what this magnetic field does is it rotates it by that. And if you go a distance dx, then the time it spends in that dx is this dx over v. So if I take the dx from here, put it there. So it's this dx over v. That's the time it spends in that thing. So how much does it rotate in that time? Well, that times omega c. So that tells me how much it rotated. And if I divide by pi over 2 meaning this angle, that tells me what fraction of electrons is actually getting transferred over here. So that then will be the delta f. This is the overall argument. So what and this omega c, as I had mentioned before, and this of course needs more discussion, which we'll talk more about actually next week anyway, about the dynamics of all this. But this omega c is like qb over m. So net result is that there is this derivative or this slope which is proportional to the magnetic field, which is exactly what I've been saying, that trying to prove that if you had no magnetic field, it would have been flat. With a magnetic field, there's a slope there. And the Hall voltage is this difference. So from this now, I could try to write what's the Hall voltage. And the idea would be that if I write the two values at the two ends, it would be equal to QB and this is I guess the dx is here, but when I go from 0 to W, the difference that I'll pick up would be this times W. So that would be the not FL minus FR, I'm sorry. What I meant was FL or R at x equals 0 minus FL or R at x equals W. As I mentioned before, of course, since no current flows in the x direction, FL is equal to FR. There's no difference between them. But the point is, it's different on one end than the other. And how much is it different? Well, that's the slope times W. W is the width of the channel. So it's the slope times W, that's it. And that's what I'm trying to write. And as I mentioned, as long as you're in this linear regime, the difference in F you could interpret as difference in chemical potential. So we could just as well, instead of Fs, call this mu. Oh, I'm sorry. I forgot to write the F plus minus F minus. And this would be it. So based on this, then I'd write the Hall voltage as, I'd write Hall voltage is equal to mu plus minus mu minus over Q. So instead of Fs, I'm writing mu's and then dividing it by Q on both sides. And then there would be a Q, B, W. This would be. So So this would be the Hall voltage, and we are talking of electrons that with a certain energy. And if I had to write the current, that of course we had before, that's like what we had here. So that would have been something like Q square d Vz over 2L mu plus minus mu minus over Q. Remember, we are not writing the integral dE minus del F del E. That idea is that we think of it one energy at a time. Now, after we are all done, we can do the summing over energies anyway. That's a separate issue. We are not even worrying about that. So current would be dVz over d2L, and this you can interpret as mu plus minus mu minus over Q. So that's this one. That's the current. And the corresponding Hall voltage would be something like this. And if you took the ratio, this would drop out, and you'd actually get a Hall resistance out of the thing. That's it. So today we are out of time. So this will, I'll start from here and finish up next day. Then get the full story. Yeah. This V? Right. Usually whenever I write as V, I mean the magnitude of the velocity. That if you that as I mentioned, this thing ZX plane, electrons could have any velocity. And when I write V, I just mean the magnitude, whatever it is. Right? And when I mean it Z component, then I write VZ. Now, in practice, whenever you have a VZ and you actually want to evaluate it, you have to do an angular average. Because you have electrons going in all directions, you have to take an average and get a number, right? And that we haven't talked about much so far. So that gives an additional factor like 2 over pi or things like that, which we'll fix next week. So we'll get to that. Okay. Thank you. Let me stop.